it will now come to order. Al Johnson, I fines you $6 for stealing that skillet and $6 for stealing the lead.
Yes, Judge.
And you are sentenced to 6 months in the jailhouse for... What's that you eating on, Ike?
This here shawman bread, Judge. You have a little bite?
Mmm. That's good stuff. Al Johnson, your sentence is changed to 6 days in jail.
Thank you, sir, Judge. Thank you, sir. I got one more little bite of shouting bread here.
You is, huh? Center suspended, court adjourned. Give me that bite of shouting bread.
Man's little baby loves shouting, shouting. Man's little baby loves shouting bread. Man's little baby loves shouting, shouting. Man's little baby loves shouting bread.
Attention, please. Do you know that Alka-Seltzer will bring you quicker relief from headaches? It will, and here are two very important reasons why. First, Alka-Seltzer is in complete solution when you take it. Thus, it is ready to go to work without delay to bring prompt, gratifying relief. Second, Alka-Seltzer's analgesic or relief-giving agent is protected by valuable alkaline buffers which prevent partial breakdown when it comes in contact with stomach acid. This claim cannot be made for many pain relievers. Remember this fact next time you want quick relief from a headache. Then ask your druggist for Alka-Seltzer tablets.
I'm sitting on top of the world, just rolling along,
rolling, rolling,
just rolling along.
Day long, day long.
I'm quitting.
And we're pointing that out there, out here, and out here. So we have the full pentagonal array. Let me just say that this is right outside the old apartment where I used to live up there at 56 Ludlow Street, up on the top floor with the AC hanging out. That was 40 years ago, and that's where we started the goings-on up there. It's where I began work on Flickr, and Jack Smith edited Flaming Creatures, and the Velvet Underground was founded up in that apartment. So I want the ambience of this neighborhood, and I'm going to just catch some of this in five channels here. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
He's played his instrument for a very long time, and he knows the power. There's something about that sound that I really love. It's just like a refined noise.
Hear 1 second of Tony's music and you know it's him. You know, there's trumpet players and then there's Miles Davis. There's piano players, there's Cecil Taylor. There's, you know, there's Tony Conrad. It's Tony Conrad music.
the sound is really just coming at you like a railroad train. You're just standing on the tracks, and here it comes, and it's...
that he would create, I found them to be very calming. Like you'd feel your metabolism sort of sinking and slowing down in a really nice way.
But he makes films and he's a professor of film, and he will do stuff in an art gallery.
He has never thought of art as not being experimental. Looking at his career just changed your perception of what time is, music is, film is, sculpture is, of what an artist can be.
I don't think he's an easy artist to take, you know. He's always gone against the grain. He's done a lot of stuff that no one even knows about. That's the crazy thing.
Bus terminal. And back in 1957, when I started going to college, I used to come up here from Baltimore on the bus. And then I even had to change buses here at Port Authority. Instead of sitting around here in the bus terminal, waiting for the next bus to Boston, I'd go over here and get on the subway. And I just go downtown and visit with my friend Lamont Young. Meet all of his druggy friends.
Tony Conrad at that time is an undergraduate at Harvard. He's working on computers. He was in the Harvard Student Orchestra at that time. So he goes out to Berkeley, and it's there that he meets Lamont Young. Lamont Young is already a very accomplished musician and composer. After he graduates, Tony shows up on Lamont's doorstep.
And they were in New York doing Wild Spacey improvised music when Tony started jamming with them.
And then when Tony introduced the contact mic, it went electric. at least the violins went electric, which forced Lamont off the saxophone into singing with Marion, because the relationship between the saxophone and the strings wasn't working anymore.
We made this music where you just engage with the sound directly. Hold the sound. Hold it. How about that sound and what it about it? And what is there in there? What kind of things are there in there, in that sound?
Tony was a mathematician and helped us understand which harmonics we were dealing with at any particular time.
Tony introduces this very reductive process in which they just settle on a few microtonal intervals. They're playing very precise pitches for a very, very long time. It's physically grueling.
Well, see, I think that one of the accomplishments of the group I worked with John Cale and Lamont Young and Angus MacLeese and Marion Zazila, was the inauguration of a minimal sensibility in music, if I can call it that, because I'm not even sure it was minimalism in the sense that sculpture defines it.
The Theater of Eternal Music was this sort of sect of musicians who met supposedly every day for 2 years and recorded all of this stuff and played one note or one chord over interminable amounts of time, that was this sort of absent center to not only minimal music as we understood it, going up to Philip Glass and performances at BAM in Brooklyn, but the prehistory of the Velvet Underground and all of these other things.
It was agreed upon that Lamont would be the group's archivist. They had rehearsed at his loft, so Lamont would hold on to all of the tapes. They recorded everything. Over the years, it had become plain to both Tony and John that Lamont wasn't going to share.
I thought it's very important to record, and the reason it was so we could hear it. I wanted to make the music so I could listen to it. And the fact that the guy who recorded it then kept it all to himself was endlessly, endlessly aggravating.
It's a real shame that that no one will ever hear what that music is. There's a whole body of work that exists from 63 to 65 and a half. I wish people could hear what we did.
We even contracted to share the recordings.
The lesson is make your own copies.
I didn't have any money. Right. Do you? I chose to be as indolent as I could. No, actually, to be as independent of the economy as I could. I didn't want to be a part of the economy, so I ate cheaply. I lived in an apartment that cost $25.44 a month. Tried to split the rent, in fact, if I could. $12.72 a month. Now we're talking. I'd go and do office temporary work. I wasn't qualified to type. I wasn't qualified to do anything, really. So I would I would do jobs like opening envelopes. You can do opening envelopes for like 3 days or something like that, and that, you know, at a certain point, that's enough.
My poet friend Pierre O'Helixer invited me to look at this place on Ludlow Street. No one lived downtown this far. Well, the rent was commensurate with the services, that's which included no toilet, no heat, and the landlord collected the rent with, as he would show, with a pistol. We would go up to the Essex Market, see? I would buy chicken hearts, which, albeit rubbery, pretty good source of protein. Yeah. And they were 15 cents a pound.
One of the books that I read cover to cover to cover instead of studying economics was this book that came out in 1982 by Victor Bakris called Uptight. It was the Velvet Underground story. You know, it had interviews with all of the usual suspects. But there was this one guy in the book. He was obviously the smartest guy in the scene, who seemed to be right in the thick of all of it. He was present at the formation of the Velvet Underground. He was an integral, crucial part of it. But, you know, like, he went on and he had other things to do.
John and I would go across town and we would wind up at my apartment, and suddenly we're listening to rock and roll records. You know, so we're going and doing this avant-garde music, and then we go home and we're listening to rock and roll records. We were invited to go meet some rock and roll producers at a party, and they wanted us to go tour a record they wanted to cut.
Before they agreed to drive around in a station wagon and play this one chord song in shopping malls in New Jersey, they're like, well, let's go meet this guy. So they go meet him. He's sort of this unassuming kid from Long Island. That kid from Long Island was Lou Reed.
Yeah, the story was that we basically were covering for the people who had put the record together, who were the executives of the label and who didn't want to tour with the record. In those days, they thought it'd be better to have, like, some post-teens with long hair. We never had guitars. We just had whatever they handed out in the car. So I'd get bass guitar or regular, you know, like, who knew, you know. They were all tuned to the same note. You know, which astonished us when we got the guitars to find that they tuned all of the strings of all of the guitars to the same note, except for, you know, like Lou, who could really sing and really play and, you know, really knew rock and roll. And we're announced as like, and here we go, like, it's the Primitives, right from New York City with their latest hit song, The Ostrich. And we go running out and play this song. And the kids say, you know, and I think, whoa, you know, like, is it like this all the time? You know, what reality am I actually in? There is something very strange about all of this, you know.
Did you feel like imposters?
Yeah. And at the same time, maybe more real. You know what I mean? Like, there's both. John went off to play rock and roll music, which I couldn't even believe he was going to waste his time doing that. I mean, I thought it was fun to do rock and roll, but I mean, really? I also resisted all ideas of professionalization. I wasn't interested in propagating the culture of musical composition as a professional undertaking, whereas people who had, like Phil Glass and Steve Reich and Lamont Young, they studied music composition and wanted to be big composers. I didn't want to be, you know, I wanted to end composing, get rid of it. I wanted to die out. So being anti-professional, and then finding these connections to underground filmmakers. Nobody knew, you know, anything about them and or what was going on. I mean, you know, basically it was kind of hopeless. I was very drawn to that. Sound that I made that was public was a soundtrack for a notorious film called Flaming Creatures. Flaming Creatures was banned in New York. It was
excoriated in the press as a pornographic, monstrous film. It was shown in Congress.
The pathway in for me had been sort of etched out ahead of me by Jack Smith. That was how I got exposed to filmmaking, was through looking over his shoulder and while he was making and editing Flaming Creatures. And then also sharing time with Jack for a couple of years meant that I was exposed to a fantastically generative set of outlooks and aesthetic ideals. Jack wrapped his presentation of self in an artistic envelope completely so that his life and art were inseparable. Jack and Mario Montez and I were hanging out, and there was a old projector that Jack had stolen, actually. Didn't even have a lens, but in the pathetic ultra-low end world that we lived in, it was so desperately important to him to watch movies anyway, even without film or reels or lens, that we turned on the projector and pointed it at Mario. I turned the frequency way down, and this stuff started happening with the light on the subject that was unbelievable. And I had the tape recorder going so you can actually hear this moment.
Oh, look! Oh, boy, it's hallucinatory. Oh, Tony, can you see that? Have your actual eyes in reality ever seen anything as exaggerated and raging as this? I mean, aside from...
I thought of structure as something that was pretty interesting. And repetition and the way that sound and light, if they're controlled in short durations, they do funny things. And I thought this was pretty, pretty cool.
Tony knew about flickering light from having read W. Gray Walter when he was an undergraduate at Harvard. And W. Gray Walter's book, The Living Brain, is really the book behind a lot of the lighting effects, the strobe light experiments, as a way of affecting people's brain waves.
I thought that maybe if there was some kind of differential scale of frequency activity along this line of interaction between fluctuating light in the brain, that maybe there would even be a basis for creating some kind of musical structures using this scale. And so I decided that I would just make a film out of these patterns and copyright it, and then I would be Mr. Flicker.
The flicker, when it's shown in 1966, is immediately a notable film. Someone supposedly throws up at the premiere. The projectionist comes down with a photogenic migraine. It's pronounced as being a very important film by some people, and it's pronounced by other people as not being a film at all.
You over, changes your way of being. If you can get that, that's cool.
People say, oh, flicker movie. If they read about it, they say, white frames, black frames. Okay, got it. You know, no.
It's not that at all. When you sit in there, something happens in the brain. You get tremendous colors after a while and shapes, and you have kind of an out-of-body experience. No LSD needed. That thing does it all. I mean, it's a tremendous experience if you give it a chance.
One third of the audience hated the film and would sometimes or often leave even before it got underway. One third of the audience would not have any real response at all. And one third would be ecstatically interested and responsive and would report all kinds of subjective, like interesting interactions and so forth. And they'd have like weird things to report. Weird things to report. Like, oh wow, I saw this wagon train encamped at a creek, and birds and letters and animals and all kinds of stuff.
The Flicker became known as a film that was as or more effective with your eyes closed than with your eyes open.
I had met Beverly Grant on the set of Ron Rice's Chumlum. Holy smoke! She was such a smoking gal. Older than I was, and I thought, wow. But, you know, out of my class, you know. And she was becoming known as Queen of the Underground, because she was in these Andy Warhol movies and Jack Smith's Normal Love, which, although it didn't come out for decades, was a big thing at the time, even just the production of it. Her personal character was so strong, incredibly strong. So when we actually met one time at a party and she turned her personality beams on me, I was swept away, and the rest was history. We moved in together. We got married. Had a son, Ted. We did work together. We collaborated. No, I was walking across all kinds of boundaries. I liked the idea of making a lot out of a little. Like, I made this film Straight and Narrow. Yeah, like, what could be simpler than black and white stripes? I thought, screw abstract art, I'm going to make abstract art funny, happy, energetic, joyful, you know, like, why not do that instead of having it religiously, like, contemplative and, like, sitting around, you know, like, things, yeah.
I had read the one Village Voice review that Jonas Mekas wrote in 73 of the Yellow Movies. And then wondered for many years, like, what does this look like? Does this person still have them? Before I ever met Tony. The Yellow Movies were made in 72, 73 for a one-day show in New York.
The
because I've loved long durations, and I love long durations in music. I loved long durations in performance. I loved long durations in relationships, too. Yeah, and so I thought, I should make a film that just beggars Andy Warhol's 24-hour-long film. I'll make one that'll last 50 years. But how? A projector or a film that ran for 50 years, it would wear out. It just wouldn't last. You can't do it. You just can't do it. You have to have a completely different conceptual stratagem. So my idea was to actually paint the emulsion on and then let the film take its own course over time. But it needs to do things very slowly, very slowly. And I imagined that this kind of cheap house paint that I used would actually turn yellow and disintegrate and fall off, and all the things that would happen with aging would happen to it in a very, very, very slow way. But I mean, of course, they probably happen to the other artwork, but those artworks aren't movies.
The yellow movies become this sort of like endgame comment on structural cinema. You had minimalism in music, you had minimalism in sculpture, and now cinema was behind in a certain way in trying to catch up with long durational minimal films. And so Tony thought, how can he jump this history ahead and kind of like derail it? I can't think of another artist who has such a sense of looking back and looking forward. It's not as simple as like completing old works or picking up on old threads, but that like when he made something, when it might have had its primary experience, and then when it's revisited and recontextualized. He's working with this stuff in such a complicated, unpredictable way. It makes for a very wily and previously illegible kind of artistic path. It's really interesting that a younger generation of writers and fans and critics can start to actually patch this all together and call it a career.
I bought a work of Tony Conrad for the collection of the Walker Art Center. And I think it was one of the hardest conversations at an acquisition committee that I had. I have to build such a case for Tony because people were like, that's not a film, but it's not a painting. And I explained it to them saying, you know, he's a very important musician, like, but this is not music. So what are you talking about? And then I told them, well, it's very important. You cannot enter the world of experimental art in the United States without talking about Tony Conrad. And one person at the table told me, well, if it's so important, why is that so cheap?
I had noticed that there was a church on the corner of 53rd Street and 5th Avenue that gave rise to strange bell sounds.
I got this job playing bells in a bell tower right next to the Museum of Modern Art. I played every day at 5 o'clock till 5:30. So I'd become a kind of a strange Quasimodo of New York.
So I went in and inquired. So I said, who's the bell ringer, you know? The guy says, oh, that's Charlie. And when it was done, I introduced myself, and it was Charlemagne. And so I asked him if he would perform some of my music on his carillon. And he did. And I recorded it.
There are certain violinists who want and need the greatest instruments in the world. Tony needs the worst instruments in the world. Those are the ones that he really appreciates and makes his famous sound.
The emblem for the New York Philharmonic is apparently a circle, sort of inscribing itself as an emblem of completeness, cosmic sanctity. Ugh. Ah! You know, when we started picketing this dump, it wasn't nearly like this at all. It wasn't even, they hadn't even built this stuff yet. This is exactly how bad it goes. These institutions get embedded in cement like this. And even to Mozart, playboy of the Masonic mysteries, I can't stay here. It's too depressing. In the 70s, I just banged on the piano for 5 years. I didn't do violin. I was doing film. I started teaching at Albright College in Reading, Pennsylvania. It was so inspiring that I thought, maybe I could be socially constructive if I did this on a regular basis. I quit my other job because we were mailing units to the South Pacific, and that was at the time of the Vietnam War, and I didn't want to do that. I wasn't going to contribute to the war, even indirectly, in any way. See, teaching, I could at least instruct people how not to work, how not to go into the military service, how not to learn all the shit that was being taught in the regular courses at the time. How not to make films, for example, in my case, and wound up at Antioch College, which is a perfect place to teach how not to do things.
So around 1972, 73, when Tony is working still with Beverly Grant out in Antioch, he finds himself taking care of their child, Ted, and he finds himself in the traditional role that women have found themselves in for millennia, which is caring for a child. So he decides that he's going to take on that persona in his filmmaking as well. Rather than creating films in a manner which can be seen as a sort of macho manner of smashing it to bits with a hammer for electrocuting it, that he's going to start cooking film. He takes celluloid, he takes various recipes, and he substitutes film for onions.
And when I decided that I wanted to use onions as a metaphor for film and processing, I decided to use the most onion-like film. And that's what they call positive fine grain print stock. I mean, that was such a beautiful, pearlescent, lovely, onion-like film stock. You couldn't even believe it.
So he starts making film in which he curries a film, or he creoles a film, or he pickles film. Instead of exposing it and developing it, he's going to make it into these different types of cinematic experiences.
It was a very, very productive time for me, but no matter how productive it was, there wasn't much to say or do to anyone else about it, unless I left town, went someplace else. When I was invited to San Diego to teach there for a half year, I started shooting this Super 8 film. The campus at UCSD where I was teaching was actually a former military base. And so I shot ludicrous scenes of one sort or another in which I differentiated between officers and soldiers.
Put your weapon down, soldier. Put your weapon down right over there. And you stand right over there. Put your weapon there. You stand over there and you bend over. You bend over. And I'm going to tell you what this army's about.
What?
You get two more.
Somehow, Tony came to find me after seeing one of my videotapes. I quite liked him. He was quite friendly, and we had a lot to talk about in relation to narrative and fractured narrative. Soon thereafter, he mentioned working on a project, this fantastical film related to a kind of broken military structure.
I said, Tony, you know any other younger artists living up in L.A. where he lived? And Tony says, well, there's my roommate. And I thought, oh, okay. But his roommate turned out to be Mike Kelly. Mike came and did the most startling performance.
We were paired up as a kind of lost troops on the side of this highway.
If this gun gets broken, I'm going to say you broke it.
I was at the screening of Beholden the Victory, and we were all really excited about it. It was like 2.5 hours or something absurd like that. And of course, he had a lot of fans from the music world and from the experimental film world. What happened was, as the movie unspooled, one group got up, walked out. Another group got up, walked out. So it was pretty hardcore rejection. I mean, it was a total, like, no, we're not going to take this.
Well, see, I wanted to create a relationship to the audience where the audience would be dismissive. The ideal audience member would say, like, well, damn it, I came here to be in charge of this movie, but look at it, it's just a bunch of junk. During the 20th century, at least, this logic was not recognizable to an audience as a workable logic, you know. And I thought, excellent, good. There's been a little trouble with the room, and so I was asked to exercise control over the use of foodstuffs and drinks in this room, okay? So I'm going to actually have to check on that now. Do you have foodstuff or drink? Oh, well then, I give you a cookie.
Oh,
look at this. You have to take all of this with you out.
I always do.
You do? Okay, but no cookie for you.
It's a conceptual approach. It's a conceptual approach to teaching. And I remember one time he said to me, I got this great teaching advice from an in-flight magazine, Jenny. And he said, what you do is you stand up and you have a piece of paper and a pen and you just sort of pretend like you're writing and you say, and you ask a question that you expect the class to respond to. And he said, and then of course none of them are going to respond. So you just keep, you know, lightly pretending you're writing and you just wait until it's agony. And then you just keep waiting even more than that. And the silence is so painful. And finally one of them will say something. And he was like, that's my teaching advice.
The thing is about a documentary is the documentary is in a completely ambiguous state right now.
He invented the Skype teaching. He's going around the world doing his shows, doing his performance, wherever he is, like Skyping with his students who are sitting. He's paying one student to get food, get them sitting, and they're there watching Tony.
Documentary has really stopped being anything very clear because it tends to get very mixed up with narrative.
Documentary has to tell a story, you know, in a way. Don't you think?
Like everybody who comes in becomes part. They meet everyone around the world.
Let me ask Tyler Hubby.
Hey, Tyler, come over and sit in the chair here a minute. This is a documentary filmmaker. He's shooting a documentary about me.
Right now.
Yeah, right now, actually.
He's been following me around, actually, doing this.
Are we recording this?
Yep.
We're recording this now, Cisa.
We're recording you recording this, also.
After 3 years down at Antioch College, the State University in Buffalo, when I got a job there, it seemed like a great opportunity to really explore how American education truly functioned, what it truly could be, and how it would be possible really to work with real life students. Not just self-selected people who understood alternative living or who came from the upper crust. No, I wanted to go the other route and see what would happen. At the time, the busiest center of activity and media within hundreds of miles was in Buffalo. And great scholars were coming through town, you know, like, oh my God, Foucault was here, and John Cage always used to come up here. Morton Feldman was teaching in Buffalo. But the main thing for me at the time as a filmmaker was that my friend Paul Sharitz was teaching here. And Hollis Frampton was teaching here. And let alone Woody and Stena Vasulka, they were teaching here. And there were a lot of visitors coming through. And there was enough money available through state funding, national funding sources, and grants, organizations, and so forth, that you could do a lot of stuff here.
You're looking at videotapes. Who's in charge? I'm in charge. I can stare you down.
He's definitely got issues with authority, I'd say. I mean, he is an authority figure. I mean, he's a professor and a very warm and giving authority figure in that role. But I think that him being brought up playing the violin and being a mathematician and so forth, these scientific and cultural absolutes were introduced to him at an early age. And, you know, he reacted. He pushed back, let's say that.
Now, of course, it's nowhere near as exciting to work with a commercially prepared rocket, but it takes a little of the fun out of it, but it still is possible to use this kind of rocket as well. You know, there's nothing wrong with trying to work with... Come up and... Step over this yellow line can get up here, because what I'd like to do is I'd like to help you tonight to learn how to shit.
I felt when I started teaching that it was a way of being socially and politically constructive. If you're a teacher, you've got like 30, 40 people at most that you really engage. And I was a teacher of media, and I thought, media? Geez, I should be on TV doing this stuff.
And we should talk to our caller,
Cherise.
Too. Cherise? Cherise? Are you on the line?
Hello.
Hi. Somebody knows you here.
That's my sister.
Oh, it is?
Hi, ugly.
A lot of people would call in and they would say, hey, I know you. And I'd think like, oh God, okay, it's her cousin or some crap, you know. And then everybody would get dispirited, oh, this is going down the drain. And I would then correct myself and realize, no, this is people interacting with their television on the subject of the most despised institution probably in the world outside of war, homework. Nobody loves homework, and we celebrated homework.
My question is, I was having trouble on common denominators, and I wanted to know if you had the answer for a common denominator for 87.
Okay.
For 88 and 7?
87.
A common denominator, well, you have to have a common denominator for 87 and something else, right? What's the first thing you would do?
I don't know, that's why I called.
He's thinking about which are the real disenfranchised communities that need mobilizing, and how can this tool really work for them? Well, nobody's more disenfranchised than kids who aren't getting their homework done. I mean, really, we're talking about, like, inner-city kids. They're not getting help any other way. The school system's failing them. And so, like, why not take public access TV and make it a living support network for a community in need?
Jewel, thanks for calling. You did that was really good.
Thank you.
And good luck with your homework, okay?
Thank you.
It seemed like this idea of doing public access TV would be an excellent system to explore. One that feeds back into the community its own images.
Well, what do you think? Is this your day to be on TV?
Oh, no.
Go ahead, come on. Go for it. What do you got to say to people out there?
How you doing?
We're trying to get... Wait. We're trying to get people to say what they got on their mind on TV, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because who knows otherwise?
The subject of the day.
Well, I don't know. You know, we don't try to create a subject because it's important for people to have their own opportunity to make their own show.
In this country, with white males especially, the name of the game is the almighty dollar.
What we would do is try to keep the cameras in the shot so that you would see what we were doing and feel like, if this isn't so hard, you can do this too.
What about getting involved in making your own TV show? Taking a camera out into your neighborhood and...
Yeah, I may do that.
Right, I would produce the show.
If you produce the show, they'll provide equipment and the cable time.
A lot of what Tony and that crew that he worked with was doing at that time was just shattering people's idea of the power and authority of media. You know, it was like, just because those guys are from Channel 13 and they have a news camera that's huge doesn't mean that they're important or that they're the authority on this subject. You too have an equal voice. And in fact, you can come into the cable access station and make your own show. I mean, Tony gave countless hours, I mean, days, years of his life to the bureaucracy of getting access to media equipment. And I really admired that too, because that was really an attempt to really like jumpstart democracy, you know, in terms of people's media access.
Now, there's one problem that I wanted to tell you about. The most important problem is I don't have a job. I don't have a job. I need a job.
Well, now that's better than yesterday, isn't it?
I began to take a number of trips up to Buffalo, and at the same time hung out quite a bit with Tony. It turned out that he was developing a... quite a big project there, which is known as the jail movie.
You say important things every day. You didn't want to hurt.
What he had done was taken this quite a beautiful long loft that he had there and built a to scale jail.
The jail had come out of a series of projects I had envisioned that had to do with institutionalized power, you know, or authority or authoritarianism. Like, I was fascinated the way that there were parallels between being a parent, being a teacher, being an artist, ordering soldiers around, ordering prisoners around, ordering students around.
All right, straight ahead. We'll go down to this cell. That's right. Into this cell. That's good. Thank you.
And he says, who wants to be in a movie? And we're going, yes. Everybody's like, yeah, we'll be in. Well, I got this idea of shooting women in prison, but they're not going to be women. So you're going to be dressed up like women.
Hey, you know, on the outside, your husband and me.
I performed with my brother, Mark, and we played two sisters, I believe, murderers.
Yeah, I'll kill you. Bridget, I'll kill you.
I mean, the whole thing was actually, for the standards of the time, was not really that low budget. I mean, it was shot in 16 millimeter black and white.
Hey.
Think a new fish is gonna come in? New smells?
Probably pretty soon.
The film didn't get finished. I ran out of money. I was shooting on film. Expensive.
I've always, since going up to Buffalo and being told about Tony's jail project, thought that it was one of Tony's all-time strongest works. I mean, he starts filming this movie. For whatever reason, he stops. He gets 4 or 5 hours of footage. And then for the next 30 years, even though he's moved out of the space where the jail is, he keeps paying rent on this space and eventually buying the building where the jail set is, with a hope or notion that he's going to return and finish the film. And the idea further being that the people who were in jail in the late 70s and early 80s, he's going to reconvene them and film again, and they're still in jail, and they've been there that whole time. That blows my mind. I think it's hilarious that he kept the building the whole time, and he kept the setup, and if you ever went to visit it, the same coffee cup that's been sitting on the ground since 1982 is still sitting on the ground. It's like he never even cleaned up there.
I put it off, and put it off for decades. And then I was getting ready to get back into it, because the quality of video had become equivalent to the quality of the old kind of film I was shooting. So I thought, I'll finish it in video.
You just go right back where you were, and you're just like, well, I don't see anything wet on the floor here.
Bought the cameras, got the jail set back in shape, you know, and everything. And then Mike Kelly committed suicide a couple of years ago, and I haven't been able to move that project forward ever since then. Mike was a very strong influence on a lot of different people.
Guard! Tell the parking lot attendant to reserve a space for my hairdresser.
One of those people, like Jack Smith, was another one that I had wonderful experiences with and was privileged to know well, and who influenced many other people in addition to myself.